And get a little further down the road today, we've been talking about what I call, or was taught to me as, the antediluvian period, but which Jesus himself says in Luke 17, verses 26 and 27, as the days before the flood. He defines the period for us. He says the days before the flood, or as the days of Noah in Matthew chapter 24. So, the antediluvian period, or the days before the flood. And so we have the antediluvian, and then we have what's coming up next, the post-diluvian, or after the flood. So antediluvian, post-diluvian, then patriarchal, and the wilderness wanderings, or excuse me, Egyptian bondage, and then the wilderness wanderings, and the conquest of Canaan. So let's do those. Antediluvian, post-diluvian, patriarchal, Egyptian bondage, wilderness wanderings. All right. This is we're building our framework of the history recorded in the Bible. So antediluvian, post, so you gotta get those rolling right off your tongue. Antediluvian, post-diluvian, patriarchal, Egyptian bondage, wilderness wanderings. You can do this. I know you were a teacher. Oh my. I know there's nothing anybody hates more than memory work, but I'm going to keep trying to drill it in you. All right. Now, so we've defined this first period as the period before the flood, which begins in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, and the period ends in chapter 8, in verse 14. And we talked a little bit last time about the configuration of the ark and the dimensions of the ark and the proportions of the ark and even the volume of the ark and all of that in order to be able to get the cargo in the ark. In other words, was the ark big enough to hold all of the animals? And the answer is certainly yes, when you understand what Noah was commanded to do. He was commanded to bring two of the unclean and seven of the clean. And some Hebrew scholars read that two and two, or seven and seven, in such a way as, well, that may indicate pairs of clean, seven pairs of clean. So that'd be 14. So even if you calculate the number of animals in the ark based on that, plus what God told Noah, that he was going to destroy everything in which there was the breath of life in its nostrils, that eliminates 98% of the animals on the planet, because the overwhelming majority of life on this planet is in the water. And then you take insects, which don't breathe. They don't have nostrils. They don't have lungs per se. So they're insects that are not. They require air or oxygen, but they do not require respiratory system like mammals and some of the lower animals have. So we're down to a much smaller number of animals, and the average size of an animal that is an air breather is smaller than a sheep. So we're talking about the ark being able to contain over 100,000 sheep quite easily. And so, but the number of animals that would be required to meet of every kind, in other words, you have dogs, there's several kinds of dogs. You have wolves, you have coyotes, you have dogs like we think of dogs, canines. And so they're all of, and it's generally thought that the modern dog is descended from the wolf. And so, but even if you just expand that, you know, and there's some that don't interbreed, then that are in that kind, there's still more than enough room, probably somewhere between 7,000 and 16,000 animals on the ark. That's still a lot of animals. Then you add the fact that they don't all have to be full grown. You didn't have to take two full-grown brontosauruses. Well, the brontosaurus is not what they call it anymore. I think it's allosaurus. But anyway, you know, you have to take two full-grown dinosaurs or whatever. So it's easily possible that these animals were in the ark. Now, another great problem that we have has to do with the flood itself. Now, in chapter 5 and verse 32, the reckoning of time is based upon Noah's life. All right, he was in his 500th year there at the end of chapter 5 when he begat Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And we observed, according to chapter 10, that Japheth is the elder. So, 500 years old, and Noah begat Japheth. And then we see that in chapter 7, I believe it's verse 11, it was in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month. So, reckoning from Noah's 600th birthday to the 601st year, second month, and the 17th day when he went, when the fountains of the deep were broken up and the windows of heaven were opened. So the flood began in Noah's 601st year. So that's how time is being reckoned. Or excuse me, 600th year. In the 601st year is when he's going to come out of the ark. It doesn't mean he was in the ark 601 years. It's the 601st year of his life, which is the basis for the reckoning of time in these chapters. So we have a flood that was on the earth almost a year. The waters prevailed. It rained for 40 days, and the waters prevailed for what was 100 and, let's see, I was reading here. They went in male and female. Flood was 40 days, and the waters increased. Verse 17, bear the ark up. The waters prevailed, were increased upon the earth, and the ark went upon the face of the waters. Prevailed exceedingly above all the high hills, and I'm going to come back and talk about that in a minute. 15 cubits upward. So 15, if we're taking the short cubit, is a foot and a half. So we're talking about 20-something feet above the highest elevation. And all flesh died in which there was the breath of life. Verse 22. All right. And only Noah and those with him remained alive. There it is, verse 24. And the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. So we got 40 days of flood. We've got an additional 110 days of water being upon the earth. Then we come down into chapter 8 and verse 5. And in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, so a full 7 months, looking back at verse 11 of chapter 7, a full 7 months, where was I already? Excuse me, a full 9 months, where was I? The waters deep on the 10th month, and the 10th month on the first day. No, I was above that. Wow, I can't even read my own notes. Sorry. All right. 150 days, then the waters stopped. Fountains of deep restrained. Waters were turned off the earth continually at the end of the 150 days in verse 3. And the ark rested in the seventh month, verse 4, on the 17th day. That's when he came to Mount Ararat, which we believe to be in modern Turkey. I couldn't prove that, but that's generally the belief of where the Ararat was. And there have been a lot of, archaeological searching for the ark and all that. And several years ago, fellow said he found it and they made the movie. And then the end of the movie, well, we didn't find it. And and I don't think they ever will find it, but we don't have to find it. That's the thing about faith. It's not predicated upon me seeing something or touching something. Faith is predicated upon sufficient evidence to justify a conclusion. Now, just believing that the thing happened is not all there is to faith, but that's a great amount about it. If you don't believe something happened, you're not going to be able to trust on anything that's based upon that fact. But there's credible evidence for us to come to the conclusion that these things did occur. If you've ever been to the Grand Canyon, that's just about enough for anybody, even though the evolutionist wants to try and explain that away. We lived in the Panhandle of Texas for a long time, and the Paladura Canyon is there. And the Paladura Canyon is part of the same layers of the canyon are the layers of the Grand Canyon at the upper levels. But one of the things that's interesting about that is that some of the levels are inverted. So if long periods of time, the laying of these layers one on top of another, and you all went to school, but some of you did when I did, back under the law of Moses, but they taught you about the geologic column. You fellows who work in oil field, you know about this, geologic column. But do you know the geologic column does not exist anywhere on the planet? In some places where you drill, the layers are missing. And then in other places where you drill, just like I was talking about at the Paladura Canyon, the layers are inverted. And then there's those wonderful things that you see that nobody ever tells you about, but if you look for them hard enough, you can find them. I've got a picture of a tree that's fossilized, that's growing through about a half a dozen of those layers. So now, and the tree is nowhere near billions and billions of years old, but here's this tree growing through these layers of, and the tree itself is fossilized, and here's all these layers around it. Well, there's no way in the world that tree was growing billions of years and those layers were being laid beside that tree. That kind of presentation clearly indicates that the layers were laid down rapidly, and that the laying down of the layers is based upon weight and settling and chemical reactions that take place in the water, which cause precipitants to fall out. Limestone being one particular formation that results from chemical reactions in water. So anyway, you have all these facts out here that are in support of not billions of years for the laying down of these layers, but rather a sudden and rapid event. One of these days, I'm going to go to Mount St. Helens because I want to go out there and see what happened there. That you're almost too young for that, aren't you, Lance?
Not,
huh? Before your time, yeah. See, when the top blew off of Mount St. Helens, a volcano, and all of that cloud and dirt and everything's up there, and the water from the rain and the all that was taking place, and all that settled down. After a few years, they went out there and started digging around and looking, and they find the same thing on the top of Mount St. Helens that we find hundreds of feet into the core of the earth, the mantle of the earth, the core of the, what is it, the top part, the crust, thank you, the crust of the earth where we drill for oil or water, these layers, all right? And so clearly that didn't happen in millions or billions of years. That happened in a matter of decades that these layers were laid down and these formations were created. So there's ample evidence to suggest this is what happened. But anyway, so in the 601st year, in the first month, according to verse 13, the waters were dried up from off the earth, and you had Noah sending out the raven and sending out the dove, and so forth. Yes, sir.
I was going to comment also, I've been on drill rigs before. We'll be drilling 10, 11, 12,000 feet, and we have to monitor what comes over our shake screen. And we've got perfect seashells. And they were small, but they would make it up through the mud column that we drilled into. Some of them broke, some of them would be in perfect shape. And they'd come over the shake screen. And they were coming from 10 plus thousand feet in the earth.
Yeah, and then you've got the ones that are on top of the mountains. You see, and this is what I'm going to deal with in just a minute, but there's an explanation for that layering over millions and billions of years just cannot explain. Only a catastrophic event like a universal flood can explain these things. So Noah came out. But when the flood was upon the earth, go back there to chapter 7 and verse 11. It says, the 600th year of Noah, the 17th day of the month, second month. The same day are all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were open. So someone said, there's no way in the world there could be enough rain to cover the earth. Well, the flood was not just based on rain. The fountains of the deep were open. So, and this is why it's important that you realize what Peter says in 2 Peter 3. The world that then was perished. We are never going to be able, and this is one of the problems I have. I mean, I don't mind so-called creation science, and I certainly don't mind people coming in and presenting evidence, even some of which I've talked about this morning, and they're much more qualified than I am. But we should not expect, this is the thing I want you to realize, we should not expect to be able to establish the facts of the Bible by scientific experimentation. And we should not be able to reconcile all that we know about our present world with some of the things that are stated in the Old Testament about the world that then was. The question of whether or not it rained. I don't have a problem with saying that it rained before the flood. Chapter 2 and verse 5 is talking about at least the fifth day of creation when the mist rose up and watered the garden because there was not yet a man on the earth to till the ground. But I also know that God cursed the earth. And so there's a lot of things that happened in that pre-flood world that I just am not able to explain. There may have not been the weather patterns that we have now then. And so, but it doesn't matter to me because that world perished and I'm not going to be able to know anything about it because there's not sufficient evidence. There's not any eyewitnesses. There aren't any records of that time other than what we have in the Bible. And everything that is historic is after the flood. The Gilgamesh accounts, the Native American accounts of the flood, all those different flood narratives that exist in almost every culture on the planet are all post-diluvian. All right? In other words, they're recorded parts of oral history that were transmitted many, many years after. So we just don't know what happened. But I don't care. Because I've got enough evidence to know that it did happen. And the Bible tells me that the world that then was perished. And so where did all the water on this planet come from? I know that they're in the opening account. Notice over there in chapter 1, if you just go back. And this is one of the things that bothers me. Verse 6, God said, let there be a firmament, an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament, the expanse above the earth, the American Standard Version says. And it would be the vault of heaven. So we're talking about the atmosphere. The firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. All right. So here's the atmosphere, and you've got water above the firmament, and you've got waters beneath the firmament. So I know we're talking about the surface water as far as beneath the firmament, but there were also the fountains of the deep, so that would be the water that is beneath the firmament. Then verse 9, God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together in one place and let the dry land appear. And it was so. Well, there are what we call seven seas on the face of the earth. They're not all in one place. Now, someone says, well, you can get to them by going around the continents. Well, that may well be so. But it seems to me that there was land and then there was water. I don't know exactly what that language is supposed to convey. Is that language talking about a vapor canopy that was above the earth and that when the windows of heaven opened that all that water came to the earth? I don't know. Maybe. Or that the weather patterns changed after the flood. That's certainly a viable possibility. I don't know. And I'm not going to argue with anybody about it. Why? Because the world that then was perished. And then God, when Noah and his family came off the ark, he gave a, made a covenant. And we call that the Rainbow Covenant. And the Rainbow Covenant there in chapter 8 says, after Noah built the altar and offered a sacrifice, he says, I will not again curse the ground anymore for man's sake. So God removed the curse. Whatever the fullness of that curse involved, I don't know. I do know that it involved man having to labor and sweat and a lot of other things. And so, so well, we still have to labor and sweat and make a living. Yes, but it's, the earth is not cursed anymore. So God took away the curse, and then he said, neither will I again smite any more every living thing as I have done. While the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest and cold and heat and summer and winter and day and night shall not cease. And I get to pick old Lance again. Back in the 80s, I used to preach a sermon, the title of which was a question. Will the earth perish in a nuclear holocaust? Because everybody was concerned about Ronald Reagan and the Star Wars and all this, and the Russians were going to nuke us and so on and so forth. And my sermon was about the second coming and the fact that it is not in the purview or the power of man to destroy this planet. God is the one who has reserved it, 2 Peter 3 again, unto flames of fire. So do what we will, we're not going to burn it up. Well, of course, that kind of, after the Cold War was over and the wall came down, that sermon wasn't very relevant anymore. And I took it and I reworked it. I gave it a new title. Will the earth perish in a climate winter? Well, no, because that's what everybody was saying. The earth was getting colder. Well, then everybody started saying what? The earth getting hotter. So now I've got to rework it again and talk about, will we perish the earth by consuming the ozone? No. Now, that doesn't mean we can't make it dirty. That doesn't mean we can't mess it up. But we cannot destroy it, because God's the only one who has that authority. It's his, and I have enough faith and confidence in God that while earth remaineth, seed time and harvest will not cease. That's the promise of God. Maybe you've heard somebody say, well, doesn't the Bible say that it's going to get to a place where you can't tell summer from winter and winter from summer? No, it doesn't say that. What it says is seed time and harvest will not cease. There will always be seasons. There will always be the time for planting and the time for harvesting. Now, that doesn't say they can't change or modify, because that's been going on this planet for as long as it's been in existence. The climates have, what's the word I want to use here? Climate has varied. That's within God's plan. You know, when somebody says, oh, it's the hottest temperature ever recorded. There's the caveat. Ever recorded. You know, I've often wondered how people who believe the earth is billions of years old and that man has only been on it for a few million years, according to them, how they think they know what's been going on in all of this time past when they barely know what's been going on in the last two centuries. Don't let that stuff bother you. That's people talking about stuff they don't know anything about. The earth is not going to perish. Well, let me get back where I was. I jumped ahead of myself. So this flood, how did this flood occur? Well, there were different sources involved for the water. There was an atmospheric source. The window of heaven was opened. And then there was a subterranean source. The fountains of the deep were broken up. And then there were geological forces, which are not detailed in the book of Genesis, but I want you to turn over to the 104th Psalm. You know, we need to read the Psalms. And if you're not including that in your daily Bible reading or regular reading of the Bible, I want to encourage you to do that. But in Psalm 106, 104 and verse 6, speaking of the Lord God, who is clothed with honor and majesty, in verse 1, He says of him in verse 5, who laid the foundations of the earth that it should not be removed forever. There it is. That's the covenant of Genesis 8, 20 through 22. As long as earth remaineth, thou coverest it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At thy rebuke they fled. At the voice of thy thunder they hasted away. They go up by the mountains. They go down by the valleys unto the place which thou hast founded for them. And what the psalmist is describing there is that at the time of the flood, there were great geological shifts on the planet. There was pushing up, and there was pushing down. You fellas in Oldfield, you know this is true. That's how you have these different layers up here on the tops of the mountains. You have these different layers down here in the bottom of the valleys, below the elevations where you may find it out here on this flat country or the plateau country. When I was living in Amarillo, I go to the museum down there at Canyon. Used to be the largest museum of natural history in the state of Texas, but it's not anymore. But they have this wonderful display over in the geology section, and they think it's telling everybody about evolution. But it's a picture. You sit down at a thing, and you can push buttons, and it lights up the underground mountains in the panhandle. And it's in the valleys of these particular mountains where the oil pools, because those mountains are made of such kinds of rock that the water, the oil will not penetrate through that. So they pool up. And this is why there's so much stinking oil out there. Now, but you go out of the museum, or you go back to my house and you look to the north, and that's the flattest country you're ever going to see. Now, if you come from the south, it's all uphill because you're coming over the cap rock and up onto the plateau. Coming from the east, it's not so noticeable because it's more gradual. But coming from the south, there's a sudden climb, and just about the time you get to Shamrock out there coming from the east, it starts getting pretty a little more steep, and you notice the change. But if you're not paying attention, it's very subtle. But the difference between where we are and the panhandle of Amarillo is over 1,000 feet. What are we here, about 300 feet? What? 255. Amarillo is over 1,300 feet. And it goes up higher than that till you get up to Clayton, and then it's up, or get on up to, yeah, Clayton. No, what is the gap there where the go through the mountains in the north and on the New Mexico line? I can't remember. Anyway, it's over 6,000 feet there. No, I'm talking about further back to the east. But you're right, that's high elevation out there too. But right there as you're going to Denver. Anyway, from Amarillo to entering in the mountains there, where you start going out of New Mexico into Colorado, it's over 6,000 feet. That's just a couple of hundred miles. And so all of this sedimentation has been laid down on top of these mountains. So some of the mountains were pushed down, and some of the mountains were pushed up, and that's where all this water went. And this is how Noah ended up on Mount Ararat. And so sometimes people say, oh, well, how in the world could there have been water 22 feet above Mount Everest? Who said Mount Everest was there? You prove it. The Bible says that the mountains were pushed up and the valleys were pushed down and the water receded into the places where God wanted it to go. And so you just need to realize what was going on. Is who else could do that but God? See? Now somebody may be saying, well, you're a nut. Okay. You're entitled to your opinion. I've been called worse. The rest of that isn't by better people than you. But no, Job chapter 38 now, which in this chapter has one of my favorite statements that God makes to Job. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Where were you when all this happened? That's my question. Where were you when all that happened? But notice in verse 8 of Psalm 38. Who shut up the sea with doors when it break forth as it issued out of the womb. What's that talking about? That's talking about the flood. When I made the cloud the garment thereof, and the thick darkness a swaddling band for it, and break up for it my decreed place, and marked out for it my bound, and set bars and doors, and said, hitherto shalt thou come, but no further, and here shall thy proud waves be stayed. So when all this pushing up and pushing down and the waters receding, that's when the oceans were formed. And that is part of the decree of Genesis 8 when he talks about as long as earth remaineth, seek time and harvest. This is the world that now is. The world that then was perished. The flood came. God did all these magnificent things where he caused these convolutions in the planet to occur. And then the world that then was is the result. And as a result, God gave the laws that govern this planet as it now is. And see, this is why the naturalist, the evolutionist, cannot abide the flood narrative or the creation narrative, because it comprehends a God who is transcendent. That's why I preached that lesson a couple of weeks ago about the transcendent God. Our God lives outside of time. Our God lives outside of space. Our God lives outside of matter, and he has to be able to transcend that. In other words, he is more powerful than that, or he's not God. And in order for the evolutionist, the naturalist, the atheist to be able to maintain his point, he must be able, as 2 Peter 3 suggests, to say all things continue as they were from the beginning. You see, this is what the evolutionist says, the unbelieving astronomer who wants to explain the earth by a big bang, which now the big thing is not so much a big bang, but a bang, an expansion, a contraction, another expansion, another contraction. And they've been saying this has been going on for years and years and years and years and years. And that's where the earth came from. And it's just a natural occurrence. And so we always ask the question, well, where did the bang come from? Where did what blew up come from? It doesn't explain anything. And there's no doubt that there was power involved, because in the beginning, God created. There's the power. There's the energy. There's the matter. There's the force. We're not denying that, but we're saying that there's the explanation. But the explanation is transcendent. The explanation exists outside of that which is created. So the creator is not bound by the creation. Rather, the creation is subject to the creator. And so the flood was caused by God to accomplish his purpose of judgment. And then afterwards, he stayed the flood and caused the waters to rescind, and he put in place the covenant, which says, which among other things, God said, I will not destroy man or the planet again as I have done until the final judgment, which is the facts of 2 Peter chapter 3. So now we're running out of time. So I want to say a few things in review with regard to the different folks that we've talked about. And I want to put the emphasis on the messianic significance of, with respect to these characters. So Adam is the first man, and he is compared to Jesus in 1 Corinthians 15. The first man, Adam. The second man, Jesus Christ. And the first Adam and the second Adam are the heads of races of people, spiritually speaking. Adam's race went into sin. So by one man's sin, all became sinners. Not that because his sin was transferred, but because of what he did, sin now had a place in the world. But because of one right man's righteous act, talking about the death of Jesus in Romans 5. So the death of Jesus, all men are made alive in Christ, and they have the ability or they will be raised from the dead, and they have the ability to be saved or reunited in fellowship with God, the Creator. So there's the comparison, there's the significance of Adam. Then Abel, who was the second-born son, he illustrates a lot of things. Just the fact that he is the second-born son and seems to have been the heir of the promise at that point. But he certainly was the one who believed. The younger was the believer rather than the elder. But he gave the first sacrifice, animal sacrifice, which in Hebrews 12 it said it is compared to Jesus. And the blood of Christ is better than that of Abel. And so there's that lesson on the atonement. And then you have Seth. And his name means consolation. And Eve says, God has given me a man child. And so he prefigures the coming Redeemer, the promise in Genesis 3. So there's the background of that, is that the seed of woman. And so from the time of the birth of Seth, man has been looking for the coming Redeemer. So there's that comparison. And then you have different individuals. We looked at Enoch, who walked with God, and Noah is said to have walked with God. Abraham walked with God. Isaac walked with God. Joseph walked with God. So to walk with God is to be a man of faith, obedient faith. So that example of being in fellowship with God through justification by grace through faith begins here with Abel and Enoch. And then you have Noah. And Noah becomes a figure of Christ in that just as Christ saved the world, one man saved the world, so Noah, one man, saved the world. He didn't save them from their sins because the world perished, didn't it? But he saved the world in that he made it possible for Christ to come into the world. And so Christ, just like you and I are descended from Noah, Christ is descended from Noah. And so Noah is the head of a great spiritual race of people, as well as all of humanity. And then you have the flood, which and everything associated with it. The flood is an emblem of eternal judgment or universal judgment at the end of the age. If there is no universal flood, why should I believe in a universal judgment? See, that's the argument that Jesus is making in Matthew 24, that the final judgment will be just as it was in the days of Noah when the flood came and took them all away. See? So there's going to be a judgment that all men are going to face. Who's going to escape? Who escaped the flood? Those who believed. Who's going to escape the final judgment? Those who believe. And then you have the ark, which we're all familiar, and we'll look at that in some detail as we're studying 1 Peter later on. But the ark is the means of deliverance. God brought Noah into the ark. So the passage says that Noah was saved by water. The same water that destroyed the wicked is the water that saved Noah. See? Then you have the flood itself as a line of demarcation. And that's Matthew 24 again. Jesus said, before the flood, or the days of Noah. So before the flood. So the flood becomes a line of demarcation. And you go back to 1 Peter 3 again. Well, what does the flood divide between? Well, it divides between the world that then was and the world that now is. It divides between the lost and the saved. See? And so there are a lot of points to be made relative to that, especially with regard to water baptism. And that's the point that Peter's making in 2 Peter chapter 3. All right, now next week, I want you to go on and read ahead through the end of chapter 11. And we're going to talk about the post-diluvian period. We've kind of gotten over there today with the fact that we got through the flood and talked about a few things that occurred when Noah came off the boat. But that's where we're headed. And if you want to keep reading ahead, because the next period after that, the patriarchal period, is going to get us through the end of the book of Genesis. So you want to, it's been kind of easy here at the beginning, but we're fixing to take a big gap. So you want to read all the way through Genesis. Thank you.